Need a few minutes to reset? Great Minds is a podcast from SBS that guides you through different meditation styles from around the world. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
SBS, a world of difference. You're with NITV Radio, on mobile, online and on radio.
We acknowledge the traditional owners of the land NITV Radio broadcasts from, the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people of the Kulin Nation and their elders past and present. We also acknowledge all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander tribes and clans we broadcast to, from the mountains to the plains, from the desert to the sea, from fresh water to salt water.
Yaman, welcome to NITV Radio. Bertrand Tungandame Ngaya. I am Bertrand Tungandame. Coming up in your program this Monday, the 24th of June, like every Monday afternoon, we have current affairs stories from a First Nations perspective shared with us by NITV's NOLA program. We also have the story of Natasha Bamblett about the her experiences becoming a mum and the importance of bringing cultural birthing practices to antenatal care. Also, Ten Canoe and Rabbit Proof Fence, two iconic films of Australian cinema to be given a new lease on life after remastering. But first, the latest news on NITV Radio.
Australia Day 1972 saw the first Aboriginal embassy erected outside Parliament.
The native title legislation must be amended.
And they've walked this land so many times before anybody came.
I am sorry.
In this bulletin, a young elder and researcher welcomed the federal government's announced support for Birthing on Country project. The Prime Minister names former New South Wales Treasurer Matt Keane as Chair of the Climate Change Authority. And crossbench politicians to introduce legislation to make housing a human right in Australia. Federal government funding to support an Indigenous on Country birthing project has been welcomed by Yolngu Elder and Health Researcher Associate Professor Elaine Lawarpa-Maipilama. The Jakamir Birthing on Country project in the remote Aboriginal community of Galwinko in the Northern Territory will receive $6 million to help boost long-term employment opportunities for local Indigenous midwives. The rate of preterm births is highest in Indigenous remote regions, where about one in five babies are born prematurely. The Assistant Minister for Indigenous Australians, Malandiri McCarthy, says birthing on country can result in a 50% reduction in preterm birth rates, which will help to achieve better health outcomes. Elaine Lawarpa-Maipilama says the funding will support the use of ancestral knowledge to help future generations of Yolngu women and babies thrive and flourish. A long-awaited Indigenous water ownership scheme has been launched in the Murray-Darling Basin. The Aboriginal Water Entitlements Program makes $100 million available to buy water in the basin with Aboriginal representatives to determine how the money is spent. An interim governance body has been set up by Environment Minister Tanya Plibersek so water entitlements can be purchased before a permanent body is established. The minister said on Saturday its directors and advisory group members were independently selected from First Nations groups in the basin. Victoria's Yurok Justice Commission was told in April native title covers 40% of Australian land, yet Indigenous people held rights to less than 1% of surface water. Prime Minister Anthony Albanese has announced former New South Wales Treasurer and Liberal MP Matt Keane will chair the Climate Change Authority. The body is responsible for providing independent advice to government on climate change policy. Mr. Keane seen as one of only a few coalition MPs to heed the warnings of a climate change emergency, will take over the role in August when current chair Grant King finishes up. Mr. Albanese says he's the perfect man for the job.
Mr. Keane understands the opportunity that the transition to clean energy represents for our nation. As a member of the New South Wales government, and he understands it as someone who has focused his working life on making a difference, not just today, but for the generations to come. And he also understands the folly that walking away from the renewables transition represents.
Independent Senator Jackie Lambie has challenged the government to repeal a ban on nuclear energy to expose Peter Dutton's shaky strategy for implementing nuclear power. The opposition leader has delivered a key energy pledge the coalition will bring to the next federal election, promising to build 7 nuclear plants across 5 states if they win. Peter Dutton claims they can complete the first reactor by 2037, which experts say is an unrealistic goal. Prime Minister Anthony Albanese says the government has no intention of repealing a ban on nuclear power in Australia. But Senator Jackie Lambie says the government should open the door for Mr. Dutton's policy, to expose the weakness of the proposal.
Quite frankly, if that's what he wants the nuclear power bit removed out of there, then I say go do it. Put it back on Dutton and let's see what he's made of. Because seriously, these are the same people that were in for 9 years, the coalition in for 9 years, that couldn't even handle low-level nuclear waste. They still could not, over 9 years, find somewhere to put that waste. And you think he's going to come out with his U-Butte nuclear bill? So you know what? Chuck the ball at him and say, here you go, mate, then. Sell it to Australia. Let's see what you've got.
Crossbench politicians will introduce legislation to make housing a human right in Australia. Under the bill, governments will be legally required to improve the country's housing supply against set targets and make properties more affordable. The bill would set up a National Housing Consumer Council to advocate on behalf of tenants and prospective buyers, whilst a separate office would be established to oversee progress on the housing strategy. Independent Senator David Pocock says addressing the housing crisis must be a top priority for politicians.
Housing is one of the biggest issues we face. And what I'm hearing from people is that they want this treated more as a human right, as something that enables our communities to function, that allows people to have a safe place to live, rather than as an investment vehicle and something that every party sort of comes with pretty ad hoc policy. We need an overarching plan, and this bill seeks to legislate a plan to ensure that the Commonwealth government of the day has a 10-year plan.
The Greens say the government needs to consider introducing divestiture powers if it is serious about policing the supermarket industry. The government has accepted all recommendations of the Food and Grocery Code of Conduct Review and has now made a stronger grocery code mandatory for major supermarkets. The Israeli Defense Force says it is investigating after a video which shows a wounded Palestinian man strapped to the hood of a military jeep. Footage shared on social media and independently verified by Reuters shows a Palestinian resident of Jenin tied to an IDF vehicle during a raid in the occupied West Bank city on Saturday. Eyewitnesses interviewed by Reuters said the man, a student, was wounded during an arrest raid, and when his family asked for an ambulance, soldiers strapped him to the vehicle and drove off. In a statement, the Israeli military confirmed it was investigating, saying the conduct of the forces in the video violated military protocol and did not conform to the values of the IDF. Still in Israel, an Israeli airstrike on a United Nations aid center in Gaza City has killed at least 8 people, according to witnesses. Witnesses say the strike hit part of a vocational college run by the UN Palestinian Refugee Agency, UNRWA, that is now providing aid and shelter to displaced families. The Israeli military defended the attack on the UN facility, saying it was targeting what it called terrorist infrastructure embedded in the aid center. A However, Asin on Al Jazeera, a Palestinian man who witnessed the attack, says all the people sheltering in the college are civilians.
All of us here are displaced civilians, some trying to get their hands on food, others searching for clean water. Without warning, Israeli warplanes fired missiles on us. This is an UNRWA center and it's supposed to be safe, but the Israelis have no regard to any limit.
Armed militants have attacked two Orthodox churches, a synagogue and a traffic police post in two cities in Russia's southern Republic of Dagestan, killing at least 15 police officers and a priest. Russian news agencies have also reported civilian casualties as a result of the attacks. Russia's National Anti-Terrorist Committee described the attacks in the predominantly Muslim region as terrorist acts. Dagestan's Ministry of Internal Affairs says two militants were eliminated and a search is underway for the rest. Mayor of Dagestan capital city Makarchakla, Yusup Umanovov, says any goal of stoking fear or conflict in the region will not succeed.
Once again, let me emphasize that there are destructive forces interested in destabilizing the situation in our region. This is not the first time we are facing such a challenge. No matter what goals the persons who have committed this inhuman act have set before them, they will not succeed in pushing our people into conflict or intimidating them. Their actions show that they and those who stand behind them hold nothing sacred.
And to sport in NRL South Sydney, Fia Campbell-Graham may not play at all in 2024 as the star centre struggles to return from his pre-season sternum surgery. Graham underwent surgery in February to try and heal his problematic sternum after it had been a lingering problem throughout 2023. It had initially been expected Graham would miss the first half of the NRL season before his return date was revised to round 18. But the 25-year-old is still yet to resume training with Rabbitohs teammates, and the club now believes he may not return at all this year. As things stand, it is possible the Rabbitohs would only consider bringing him back if they remain a finals hope late in the season. And now having a look at the weather around the country, Broome, sunny 19, Perth, partly cloudy 18, Adelaide, showers 14, Melbourne, partly cloudy 13, Hobart, also partly cloudy and 13 degrees, Albury-Wodonga, mostly cloudy 12, Canberra, similar forecast 12 degrees, Wollongong, mostly sunny 17, Sydney, similar conditions 18, Newcastle, much the same 18, Brisbane, partly cloudy 22, Townsville, sunny 24, Cairns, also partly cloudy 27, Alice Springs, sunny 19, Darwin, similar conditions 31, and at West Strait Islands, a mostly cloudy day and a top of 29 degrees. And that is NITV Radio News.
NITV Radio, Monday, Wednesday, Friday at 1 p.m. or anytime online.
And that was We Don't Talk About It by Thelma Plum. It's a poignant statement on the culture of silence in Australia when it comes to violence against women. I'm Bertrand Tungandame, and you're listening to NITV Radio, broadcasting from Nam on the Kulin Nation. Still to come in your program, the story of Natasha Bamblett, about her experiences becoming a mum and the importance of bringing cultural birthing practices to antenatal care. And Tent Canoe, as well as A Rabbit Proof Fence, two iconic films of Australian cinema to be given a new lease on life after remastering. But first, some current affairs stories from an Indigenous perspective brought to us by NITV's NOLA program. A new 10-year remote housing agreement has been signed in the Northern Territory between two governments and the four major Aboriginal land councils. The $4 billion federal investment is designed to halve overcrowded housing in Aboriginal communities in the Northern Territory. NITV's Northern Territory correspondent Emma Kellaway travelled to Milikapiti on the Tiwi Islands for the signing of the agreement.
A first look at a fresh build. For these local residents, it's a move into a new home they've spent years waiting for.
I've moved in with him in 2009 and I applied for a house then because that house was rusted. So 15 years I've been trying to get a house.
Nine people squeezed into a three-bedroom house is how they currently live. It's a common story for many families in remote areas.
There's like three in a room or four in a room and they just don't like that. So sometimes if they're not in the room, they'll get their mattress and sleep in the lounge room.
Overcrowding in the Northern Territory remains 43% higher than the national average. This week, ministers met with leaders from the Territory's four leading land councils to forge a partnership they hope will halve that.
What it means for the Northern Territory is 2,700 new homes in the bush.
$4 billion between the Northern Territory government and the Commonwealth to halve overcrowding in the next 10 years.
A 2018 housing review found double that is needed in half the time to reduce overcrowding. 2 years ago, the National Audit Office found the Territory government had only achieved 19% of its remote housing targets.
The agreement also includes better repairs and maintenance for existing houses, a key concern for residents living in communities like Millicarpity.
We got like loose stuff in our house, tiles, and then there's just rust underneath. Like you can feel that house is ready to cave in.
With demand for new and improved housing growing faster than those being built, it's a small step forward with a long way to go. Emma Kellaway, NITV News.
And the Federal Court has recognised Queensland's Kabi Kabi people as the native title holders of the state's Sunshine Coast. The ruling marks the end of a 30-year battle for recognition and one of the first successful claims over a heavily urbanised area on Australia's east coast. Danny Rennie reports.
With its pristine beaches, islands and mountains, Queensland's Sunshine Coast is one of Australia's best-known tourism destinations. Outside the federal court, it was an emotional moment for the newly recognised native title holders.
I've got to acknowledge my ancestors and I've also acknowledged my elders. A lot of them have passed away since it started. Without them, we wouldn't have got it started.
The group was awarded non-exclusive native title rights to more than 10,000 square kilometres of lands and waters on the Sunshine Coast, from Noosa to Bribie Island.
But otherwise, the native title does not affect anyone's house or land, where they live. People aren't going to come and camp in mum and dad's backyard because that's freehold land. That's extinguished native title.
The claim is also the first in southeast Queensland that gives native title holders the right to take resources from the area for any purpose. Previously, that right was confined to personal, communal and non-commercial uses.
The right to take resources in an unconstrained way. There's no society on the planet that didn't trade their resources.
The decision comes after the applicants struck agreements with the state and federal governments and seven local councils.
This is now hope for my children, my grandchildren, and what we can do on our country moving forward and as Australians together.
While the determination is a significant victory, the work continues. Some parts of the claim are still under negotiation around urban areas. Dan Rennie, NITV News.
And staying in far north Queensland, where communities will get a reprieve from skyrocketing cost of living expenses with a 20% discount on groceries. As Dan Rennie reports, this comes after the state's premier announced a major boost to a freight subsidy scheme in the region as part of a big spending pre-election budget.
The cost of living in remote communities is often 3 to 4 times higher than other areas. Essential items like fresh vegetables, bread and milk will now be cheaper after the Queensland government lifted its freight subsidy in the far north from 5 to 20%.
20% is a huge increase for those communities and it is going to make a lot of difference. Everywhere I've travelled, I've heard of the challenges of keeping up with everyday essential items, and I know this is going to support families, it is going to support businesses, and I'm just so proud to represent a government that is listening to Queenslanders.
But customers won't see discounts just yet. Negotiations are still underway with 32 suppliers to implement the changes, which should come into effect next month.
This is designed to address the excessive cost of groceries, particularly fresh food. It's expected that this additional subsidy will decrease the cost of a bottle of milk from $5.40 to $4.32. This is a very direct contribution to address the escalating cost of buying food in remote parts of our state.
But the discounts won't flow to the Bowser. The cost of fuel is excluded. Soft drinks, clothing, furniture, and white goods are also out, along with alcohol and tobacco. The announcement greeted with cautious optimism.
I think the government just maybe one of their ploys. I'm not sure. They could be saying that, look, we're going to put another subsidy there, and whether it happens in the near future, whatnot, it's always a wait and see. And maybe they are chasing boats or trying to win some people over now, you know, to stay in government.
The discount scheme will cost $64 million and will run for 18 months ahead of a review. Facing an election in October, Queensland Labor has splashed $11 billion on cost of living relief measures in its recent budget.
This is all about addressing what Queenslanders have said to me, which is their number one concern right now is how much it costs to pay for the basics. And we want to support these remote communities so that they can put fresh food on the table for their families.
Cheaper groceries to shore up political support. Dan Rennie, NITV News.
And that's the last story shared with us by Nala, an NITV program focusing on current affairs from a First Nations perspective. Now time for a break. When we come back, Natasha Bumblett in conversation with Dr. Michaela Couch, talking about pregnancy care for Indigenous women.
Visit sbs.com.au/NITV Radio.
Music is the medicine. And that was Mary Jean by Baker Boy, coming to NITV Radio, broadcasting from Nam on the Kulin Nation this Monday afternoon. Now, time to explore the inspiring journey of Natasha Bumblett, a remarkable First Nations woman who is an empowering mother, loving big sister, authentic speaker, and cultural educator. Natasha's story began a decade ago with the birth of her first child, which marked a significant turning point in her life. Through the journey of pregnancy and parenthood, her perspectives and priorities shifted, prompting her to challenge the life she knew. Natasha shared her story in a conversation with Dr. Michaela Couch of Black Medicine, a health podcast for Indigenous people by Indigenous people.
Join the conversation on radio, online and mobile. You're with NITV Radio.
Lots of women can connect and relate to some part of my story as they've experienced that as well. Just understanding, you know, the contrast in my first and second birth, how much more informed I was and how that empowered me to experience the birth I did with my second ledge. So,
were there any highlights that you'd like to share so that other people could also think about that for their birth space, or anything that you wanted to highlight that maybe the most important thing that you thought from the first to the second birth?
Having a midwife that was really clear on what it is that I wanted, and that come from me not wanting the same experience and not even just asking but saying, this is what I want, what's possible? And they were pretty much like, whatever it is that you desire will support, you know, that experience to take place as much as we can with what's in their control. And because things had took a really quick turn from my home birth plan with my second child, one, because I was quite fearful of having my birthing experience in the hospital because of the trauma that I'd experienced in the first birth with Jirali, that I didn't want to be in, I guess, an institution in that way. And the highlight for me was knowing that the safest way to birth my baby at that point of time, him being breech, was I had this woman and this team that were there with me every step of the way, advocating and echoing my wishes and desires. And even though it was quite, you know, intervene with a cesarean, lots of medical procedures and processes in that way of birth, that every step of the way I was reassured. People were telling me what I was asking, like they were echoing that back, making sure that I was understanding what was going on every, you know, every process, every step. And I still got to have this cultural feel to me that was the ceremony that I'd always wanted. And even though it was in the hospital, you know, my baby was taken with his father, and, you know, he'd always had that family connection. And then he went straight into the Coolerman and Possum Skin as like his first point. And even though that, you know, your baby's taken away from you in that period, I was okay knowing that that was the process that was put into place for him, and that when I was reunited, you know, it was Dad that bring baby back to me. You know, it wasn't the hospital. It was in between that contact of me and my baby, and it was us the whole way through, and it was just really beautiful, and it was the healing I needed to experience for my birthing process, and I'm sure my next birth will be even more so in the way that I would like it.
Yeah, that's so lovely. I like when you bring culture into the birth space, it just brings so much history and beauty, and like I'm nearly crying thinking about those things, because I know my mum didn't have those options, and my nan, like if Nan had those options, she would be like, it would just be so nice for her, because so much of her culture was taken away from her. And yeah, it just makes me want to cry.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's, you know, I feel really blessed to come from strong lines. My grandmother was actually birthed underneath a birthing tree, you know, with culture and traditional, you know, ceremony and law that was a part of her birthing lineage, and, you know, her being a part of the Stolen Gen, it felt like a real priority and something that I valued, even though that I live in this time and this way that's very modern and westernized. How do I bring culture in every part of my life? And as a woman, having the opportunity to birth is special in itself. You know, I felt very lucky to have not only one, but when I fell pregnant with my second, that was a real blessing. And I was like, I want to do it in a way that I get to feel closer to my ancestors, my culture, the ceremony that's taken place for thousands of years, and still in a way that I was, you know, medically supported in the way that it needed to be and needed to happen for the safety of me and my baby. And I'm sure next one will hopefully be at home and more of that on country type of feel.
Now, what would your advice be for the practitioners who are listening to this in the birthing space, and how can we improve our practice for our patients?
The simplest thing, and I continue to say this with anyone that is working on this country and working with First Nations people or communities, is to get to know who it is that you're working with. You know, not just what you read on paper, but hearing from the patient themselves, and understanding that you and your team are all on the same page. Pre assumptions can really damage relationships or connections in the experience of women, and understanding that there is culture that still exists in women today, no matter, you know, who they are, where they live, or how you perceive them to be an Indigenous or, you know, Torres Strait Islander patient. It's about understanding the culture yourself and, you know, the practices that have been here, and that it can be really scary and daunting for First Nations people to be birthing in hospitals as an institution that was once seen as a separation and removal of children. And as I spoke to in that story, that was the fear that I'd carried, not only just in the birthing period, but in my pregnancy. You know, worried about somebody picking up my file and reading that I was 19 years old, an Indigenous woman. You know, and then I got gestational at the end of the, you know, 5 weeks before I'd birthed, and, you know, what all those things can mean to somebody that's in the practice, and what pre-assumptions that could have, you know.
It breaks my heart working in this space, and I know exactly what you're talking about, because you just listen to some times through the handovers and through the processes, and you're like, that doesn't represent the patient at all, and you're like, ah,
yeah,
bashing your head against a wall, being like, we live in 2024, mate, like, this is not okay.
Yeah, and I get there's lots of processes of people, depending on the stay, some people might have a number of staff members or doctors or people that they'll see in their time, but it's taking it for the face value of what you see, and understanding that there's so much more than the birthing experience that's happening. You know, they may be a removed child themselves, or you know, a sibling of, or their mother or grandmother were a part of the stolen generation. So understanding that there's a history that you don't see, and to just being mindful in the interactions and mindful of the language that we use and what that means, what different words mean, that could be either harming or healing in that process. And I just think allowing people the option, you know, I didn't know that I could do the birthing with the Coolamin and the possum skins and, you know, ask for these wishes, because I didn't feel the courage or empowered to ask, or didn't have the information. So whatever woman you have in front of you, it's do they feel informed, because from there they can make empowering decisions that support their process and the first moments of their baby's life. And that, from that moment, that really builds the connection that the mother will then have with their baby. And if it's traumatic and, you know, very disconnecting and disempowering, that first interaction may leave that imprint. And just knowing that we're impacting lives, and like, what a privilege, what an honor that is for you to have, you know, to have that opportunity in front of you, that you're going to impact somebody's, you know, life. And it did impact me for 8 years.
Yeah. Oh dear. Yeah, I think as practitioners it's really important to recognize exactly the imprint that we leave on people. And there's always the poster at my work on the doors that says, whatever you do today, you know that your impact will have a leaving, lasting memory on this patient forever. So really focus on that. And you will always remember the person who birthed your baby and who was with you in your birthing process and in your antenatal care and postnatal care. And most people will always remember that.
Yeah. My son, Jirali, the oldest boy, we'd only seen the doctor who'd birthed him like last week, and he was like, Mum, that was the doctor that birthed me. And, you know, I feel very lucky for that man, because with all the complications and the processes, with the time that I'd had, you know, 5 days in hospital trying to go through this birthing period for my son, Jirali, he come in, I probably had the least amount of time with him. He come in and he had a job. He did his job really well. And, you know, he knew exactly what I needed for where I was at, and he delivered really well, and my baby was delivered in the process. And, you know, just to have someone to step in and to assess that situation and what is going to be the best for this, you know, mother and child situation. And, you know, he did that, and that will last forever, you know. Mm-hmm. and how that impact is rippled on. And I guess if I'd had that earlier on, maybe things would have been different. But when you think about it, that's my son's entire life, you know, and that's a small part of mine, you know, 7 to 8 years, that impact on how will my next one be. And, you know, there was a lot of fears carried into the birthing of Ledge, you know, that pregnancy period. And I put the things into place, and I had the team that were there from the start, you know. And I think if you have that plan at the start, it saves all of the unknown and people coming in and trying to fill that for you, rather than you being the director of your own story in how it is that you birth.
And that was Natasha Bamblett in a conversation with Dr. Michaela Couch. And this story is part of episode 9 of the Black Medicine podcast series. We'll bring you the rest of the story in upcoming programs. Now, if you want to listen to this story again, or just the entire series of the Black Medicine podcast series, it's all published on our website, sbs.com.au/NITV Radio. Time for a break, and when we come back, we'll look at how First Nations films, considered milestones of Australian cinema, are about to be given a new lease on life.
NITV Radio, on radio, online and mobile.
Welcome back. You're listening to NITV Radio with me, Bertrand Tungandame, broadcasting from Nam on the Kulin Nation this Monday afternoon. Now, tent canoes and a rabbit-proof fence are both considered milestones of Australian cinema and are about to be re-released after being digitally remastered. Both movies, of course, tell First Nations stories, and their directors say the films have left a legacy well beyond the movie house. And a warning to our Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander viewers and listeners, this report contains images and voices of someone who has died. Biwa Kwan reports.
Maybe it's a bad ending. Maybe it's a good one.
Ten Canoes is the first feature-length Australian film made in Indigenous languages. Set in Arnhem Land in northern Australia, the film follows the story of an Aboriginal warrior who joins a group of men in building ten canoes to go into the swamps to hunt goose eggs. Interwoven in the tale is a story of forbidden love, kidnapping, and revenge gone wrong.
It's my story. My story you've never seen before.
It came about due to constant badgering of director Rolf De Heer by his good friend and legendary actor, the late David Gulpilil. The director admits he didn't want to make the film because of the difficulties of shooting in a location as extreme as Arnhem Land. When he suggested it to the studio, he expected it to be rejected.
And so I said to the office, look, how about we do this? We do this film in language and around the swamp, you know, mosquitoes, the crocodiles. I rang David that day after I'd spoken to my family, and they said, no, Dad, you got to do it, Dad, you got to do it, you know. Well, okay. I rang David, and 4 days later I was up there and speaking with him and his mob, and out of that came Ten Canoes.
Rolf de Heer says he was the conduit by which the film was made, but the story came from the Rumiginning countrymen.
I had to make sure that they felt real and had real ownership of the process and of the film. The process grew organically out of, and the script grew organically out of that working process.
Rubber Proof Fence premiered in 2002, bringing the Stolen Generations to the public consciousness in a way that hadn't been seen before.
Every Aborigine born in this state comes under my control. Notice, if you will, the half-caste child. These children are my special responsibility.
Come for the three girls, Maud!
No!
More, Maud!
It is my responsibility to teach them right from wrong so that they will be no different from you or I.
The film is loosely based on the true story of three Aboriginal children, Molly Craig, her sister Daisy Catterbill, and cousin Gracie Fields, who were forcibly removed from their mothers in 1931 under the Western Australian Aborigines Act. The policy was one of a number implemented by authorities across Australia that resulted in the forced removal of generations of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children from their families. It's estimated as many as one in three Indigenous children were taken between 1910 and the 1970s, affecting most First Nations communities in Australia. In Western Australia alone, almost half of the population have stolen generation links. Director Philip Noyes says he had to overcome plenty of negativity to get the film made.
All my friends here in Australia said, don't do it. You'll never get the money and you'll never find an audience. Australians don't want to see stories about Indigenous experience. And those were fighting words for me. And I was determined to prove them wrong, that we would raise the money and that we would find an audience, not only in Australia, but around the world.
And the film did stir controversy. Then-Government Minister Erica Betts demanded the director apologise over the portrayal of the treatment of Indigenous Australians. Mr Noyes says the newly remastered film has left a legacy.
And the reason that I've spent the last year of my life bringing this film back to life is for the next generation.
Yeah.
The film has now been future-proofed.
Mr de Heer says likewise, Ten Canoes has a resonance and relevance today, nearly two decades after its release.
Its timelessness is what it is. The whole notion of the storytelling in it is that it was meant to be, this is what they wanted, it was meant to be effectively a synthesis of their way of storytelling and our way of storytelling so that their kids could watch it and appreciate it, but also audiences outside could appreciate and watch it.
Ten Canoes will screen again at the Sydney Opera House on June 29th. And Rabbit Proof Fence will have a national release in July during NAIDOC Week. Biwa Kwan, SBS News.
Join the conversation on radio, online and mobile. You're with NITV Radio.
They got them numbered bank accounts. The system assures they win. They exploit the population. We're on the outside looking in. Them pillars of society. Drivers like a tool. For them that's cool.
And that was Pillars of Society by Cave Comedy. And the song is lifted from Cave Comedy's album Pillars of Society, which was described as arguably one of the greatest protest albums ever. And that's all we have time for on NITV Radio this Monday afternoon. Your program will be back with more stories and news from right across the country on Wednesday. I'm Bertrand Tungandami, thanking you for your company this afternoon. Till next time, bye for now. Yalu.
Need a few minutes to reset?
Great Minds is a podcast from SBS that guides you through different meditation styles from around the world. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.